We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Well, as I walk around the campus coming up here today, and as I can look at you now, I can conclude that the university is full of lovely people. Not just flattering the audience, you just look around. Look around at yourselves and ponder for a moment, and I know that you thought there was a particularly lovely person on the other side of the room, but I'm talking, not about that particular idiosyncrasy. What have we got? We've got people who are young, we've got people who are healthy, we've got people who are good looking, because they are young and healthy, who are intelligent enough to get in here, and who on this world standards, of course, are very wealthy. We dress well. Even when we dress down, it's a studied dress down, isn't it? But we dress well, we travel well, we own books, bags. We come from a fairly middle-class Australia, a very middle-class Australia. All the attempts at having free education, free tertiary education, from the late 1960s through to the 1990s proved a complete failure of bringing anybody into the university except the middle class. That's why they've reintroduced fees, although we don't call it fees, just hex. But that's why it came back in, because the middle class are the only people who come. That's what you are, middle class. Or some of you are the lower middle class driving on the way upwards, but that's we're all. And of course, if you're middle class Australian, you are, in the terms of this world, in all over the world, and in terms of the history of mankind, incredibly wealthy people. And I know that there's someone next to you who's richer, but generally speaking, we are fairly well off. And what's more, we're on the way up. Most of us will rise up the socioeconomic ladder above our parents. That's what university does for us. That's why our parents were so keen to send us here. Unless, of course, you come from parents who are at the top of the rungs already, and then it's pretty hard to go above them, isn't it? But apart from them, most of us will go up above on a career projection that will be of achievement and success and power and significance. You don't feel it now, but if you stand back and analyse the sociology of university education and tertiary education, that's what it's about. That is, as we leave university as graduates with one degree, as we leave, we actually start the bottom rung of graduate wages and salaries. We start on the average Australian income. You check out what the graduate earns, and it depends which faculty you're in, of course, and that depends whether you earn it all at the end, doesn't it? But I won't mention that faculty for which there is no jobs. But as we start, if you check out the graduate salary, you'll find that it is just roughly the same as the Australian average salary. From there on in, we go upwards. We start where the world rests. Now, we're on the up and up. And so soon after graduation, 5-10 years after graduation, you will have acquired the symbols of success. What are the symbols of success of the young graduate? Think ahead. Think to the time when you're 30. That's the end of life, isn't it? There's no life beyond 30. Abby Hoffman said back in the 60s, never trust anyone who's over the age of 30. And when he was over the age of 30 and found to be making a lot of money, people said to him, well, what about that statement? He says, well, I told you not to trust me. So, okay, when you're 30, when not you, but the graduate, the average graduate is 30, what are the symbols of the success that you would expect to see? What will they have? What will they flaunt? What will they own? What will they have done? Where will they have been? What are the symbols that are signed that they are actually successful? Sorry? Sports car? The overseas trip? A mortgage? You're not successful unless you're deep in debt. The only way to get ahead in this world is getting into debt. Three-bedroom house, quarter blaker rock, quarter acre block. Now, if they're really successful, it'll be in the eastern suburbs. Yep. Four-wheel drive. Yes, that's a great one these days, isn't it? Especially drive around the eastern suburbs. Sort of rough out here. Really got to know how to get up those hills at Coogee, knowing exactly the angle of the car sitting at as you go up, yes. Two matching dogs. You know why they go for the matching dogs, don't you? It's because when you go on the overseas trip, you can put them down. Whereas if you had children, well, you're not allowed to put them down. You've got to take them with you or warehouse them out to other people. But dogs, you can kill them and buy a new set when you come home. It really is. That's a choice, children or dogs. Go for dogs, you can put them down. Sorry? 2.3 kids, yes. With room enough in that back seat for the little one, yes. Sorry? A weekender, yes. Preferably Avoca. That's the kind of standard up and up middle class kind of environment, isn't it? You wonder if anyone actually lives in Avoca, except for weekends, yes. That's the kind of thing, isn't it? One of the ones that comes very early out of university, mobile phone. It's called, actually, it's very ancient. They had them in the ancient world. I don't know if you hadn't knew they had them in the ancient world, but they did. Yes, it's called the ball and chain. It means that you can be got wherever you are, whenever you are, and made to be responsible and do your job. I'm glad that the beepers are going. I never owned a beeper, and now we've moved to mobile phones. You don't need to own a beeper anymore, do you? I intend never to own a mobile phone. So, yeah. A credit rating, that's another important thing to have if you're on success, isn't it? Now, they're all the symbols of success, aren't they? Throughout the world, people are not actually like us. Throughout the world, people live in massive poverty and horror and sickness and racial fighting and war and famine. Oh, sure, there's North America, they're richer than us. There's Japan, more crowded than us. There's England, got a greater history than us, but India and Africa and China, the Russian Empire as was, the repression is everywhere. And the repressed and the oppressed are all around the world, and they're reduced economically and materially and militaristically to servitude. Afghanistan is still not sorted out. Iraq, Iran, Somalia, Rwanda, Chile, China, Croatia. Where do you want to go? I can't pronounce that last one that we're having the big battle in, Chechnya or whatever it is. Throughout the world, people are in terrible state. Look at chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. I'm not actually going to read through the three chapters of today's study continuously. I'm going to pick snippets back and forth out of them, and so it will reward those of you who have read through the three chapters continuously before I come that you'll know that I'm not destroying the context and the meaning. And those of you who are not doing the work of reading through the three chapters, you're a little bit vulnerable now, aren't you? Because am I taking them out of context? Do read ahead for next week, won't you? Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they had no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressor, and they had no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. Better still, better than both, is he who is not yet born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. See, there's the character of life. But what we're dealing with is not statistics, friends. You can talk about the millions of people who are dying each day. You know that measles is still one of the chief reasons that little children die in the world. Measles. So easily cured, so easily looked after, so cheap it is for us to look after it, and yet it is still one of the major world killers, because we wealthy people are much more interested in our kinds of diseases than the diseases that are killing children everywhere, that are not our disease, so we're not worried about it. No, friends, it's not the statistics. There are names to these children. There are parents who mourn them and grieve them. There are brothers and sisters who miss them. They are people who lived and who loved and who ate and cared for one another, but who never get the chances that we get. Better for some than they never be born than come into life in Rwanda or Somalia, parts of the Sudan which have been at war for 30, 40 years. People live always hungry, always desperate. That's how the world lives. Better not to have been born into it. Versus it. But still, in our optimism, we hope for better. In our optimism, we think that our society will solve it. We think technology will solve it. We think the one world government will solve it. It's a great quote from J.F. Kennedy. All man's problems were created by man and can be solved by man. He said that before he was shot by a man. I mean, that's 30 years ago, isn't it? 62, what are we talking about? 32, 33 years ago? We're no further closer to it then than we were then. It was stupid then, it's stupid today. It really isn't true. The UN discussions are continuing. The best they ever can do is put Band-Aid on the problems, on the cancers. Depression, poverty, war is endemic to the human condition. Look at chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. Chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all, and the king himself profits from the fields. One thing that is inevitable in this lifetime, friends, taxes. It's always that way. Officialdom never solves the problems of the human condition, because officialdom makes itself wealthy out of the problems of the human condition. That's what it's there to do, to look after officialdom. That's what a characteristic of life is like. You look at the public service and the civil service. They do provide roads, they do provide hospitals, but they do provide more than roads and more than hospitals, their own salary package, their own superannuation payout. Their own wealth and prosperity is what it's really about. Do you ever see that TV series, Yes Minister, and then Yes Prime Minister? It's a series that I think is fairly timeless and should be shown regularly on the television, because it really does raise the issues of what the public service is about. It is so close to the bone. The bits and pieces that I've known of life, like this one series on electing a bishop in the Church of England, is so close to the truth that you squirm the whole way through it. In it, there's one show I can remember well where the minister finds out that there is a hospital that has been up and operating for the last 3 years that doesn't have any patients. It doesn't actually employ too many doctors either. It just employs the administrative staff necessary to employ a hospital, run a hospital. And they've found that by not having operations and things like that, they're able to keep the costs down. They don't need as many cleaners. And that is fully operational hospital, which hasn't actually looked after one sick person, but it operates well. Well, Canberra is like that in the end, isn't it? You see, I'm sorry for those of you who come from Canberra. I really am sorry for you. But Canberra is just like that. Do you know that Canberra has more hospital beds per population than anywhere else in Australia? Do you know that Canberra has more teachers per student than any other school system in the rest of Australia? Do you know that Canberra has the best roads of any other part of Australia? Do you know that Canberra has the best of everything than any part of Australia, and they are there serving the rest of us? No, they are there serving themselves. That's what it's about. You social workers, just, I've got to be very careful with social workers because they are such sensitive people. But do ponder, dear social workers, when you graduate and when you earn your graduate salary, do just every now and then have a little cogitation as you drive home from the slums in which you work back to the kind of comfortable middle class environment where you can house your Volvo comfortably. Do just contemplate for a moment as to whether you are actually helping the needs of the poor or helping the project and prospect and the upward mobility of the social worker. Because in the end, the majority of the aid winds up in the social worker's pockets, not in the recipient's. That's where it goes to. Now, friends, it's all up and down the system. There's no grounds for optimism in the system of the world. Governments everywhere make governments wealthy and take more and more taxes, which are always geared against the poor rather than the rich. All taxation systems are like that. They always work out that way because the rich people always can devise methods to employ commerce graduates from the University of New South Wales to tell them how to avoid their social responsibility in paying taxes, whereas poor people cannot afford the commerce graduate. Who haven't I insulted today? Anybody left out and feeling kind of diminished because I haven't mentioned their faculty yet? I'll come to it later. But the whole lot is not improved But maybe there are some sections that are. You know, the whole universe is going to entropy. It's all kind of just falling apart. But there are little sections that some people would say, like our world, which are going against the kind of dissolution of the universe. And we are on the upward kind of environment where things are getting better and better, not part of the grand kind of death that the world is going to. Well, likewise, the whole system may be immoral and corrupt, but certainly there are little bits that could be better. What about our careers? What about our work? What about our mobility? What about our upwardness? One author says, our author here says, it all comes from envy. Chapter 4, verse 4. And I saw that all the labour and all the achievement springs from man's envy of his neighbour. And this too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Oh yes, certainly people do strive hard and they do work hard, but they strive hard and work hard in order to beat each other. Competition lies at the heart of our activities. That, of course, is the horror of this new mechanism that has come in over the last 20 years, thanks to the statistics people, just another group to kind of insult now, of marking on the curve. We no longer investigate to find out how much a student has learnt. All we're investigating now is to find out whether the student has learnt more than the other people in the class. You don't have to be bright, you just have to be brighter than the people around about you. That's all that matters now, isn't it? You've got to beat others. Our learning is motivated by beating a certain percentage in the class. It helps to get into dumb classes. You don't have to work so hard to compete. But it's like that. Or there's another motive in chapter 6, verses 7 to 9. Chapter 6, verses 7 to 9, all man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. What advantage is a wise man over a fool? What does a poor man gain by knowing how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless and a chasing after the wind. Oh no, it's greed. That's another factor in it, isn't it? To feed the face, which is never fed. But no matter how much we have, we can always want more. We can always want bigger. We can always want better. You notice it with the kind of status symbols that people have. The computer, doesn't matter how good your computer is, a new better one comes out a week or two later, doesn't it? And it's always got some new aspect of it which you didn't have. Same with hi-fi people. I'm always sorry for someone who really gets into quality music reproduction, because no matter how much money you spend, you'll find somebody else who spent just that little bit more who can get it just that little bit better. I mean, ultimately your hearing is lost, and so you can't pick the difference, but you still will know the price tag. It's always better. And it's never ending. And so you work for more. It's like people with cars. You know those kind of engineering students who just talk cars, cars, cars? And they're always trying to zoop it up with just a little bit more. And if you can just put this gadget in and that gadget in, then you can get just all this more power so that you can get a car that is totally undrivable on any road known to human existence. But you have the biggest noise, the most powerful engine, the greatest thrust that is available to anyone who's still staying on the planet. It's all got to do with envy. It's all got to do with rivalry. It's all got to do with endless greed that is so utterly and completely pointless in the face of millions of people dying of starvation and of disease like measles. What we waste our money and time and effort on. Oh, look at the man who works for himself in chapter 4, verse 8. Chapter 4, verse 8, there was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless and a miserable business. You know, working for yourself like that is a terrible waste of time and effort, isn't it? Feed his face? Well, he can make that much, and then what do you do then? You've got no one to share it with, no joy, but there's just this compulsive behaviour of keeping on working and working and working. But maybe it's not like that. It is, of course, for a growing number of people in our society. This morning's Herald had a graph which I found fairly difficult to read carefully, but as best I could read it, 460,000 people, 460,000 people in New South Wales live alone. That's an incredible statement of the nature of our society today, isn't it? But maybe it's not the meaningless of living alone. Maybe it's political power. I mean, I may be able to do something worthwhile and significant. Maybe if I rise to power and prominence and significance and become a leader in the community, then good could happen from it. But who will your successor be? Look over to chapter 4, verse 13 to 16. It's very difficult to know how to translate this passage, but the point of it is clear. It's a trick. Better a poor wise youth than an old foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. You see, a teachable young man is better than an old fool to be the king. But yet, if you replace the old fool with a young teachable man, what happens? Well, the youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless and a chasing after the wind. Now, before the king comes to power, everyone is for him. But the honeymoon in politics is fairly short, friends. Within a few years, people are more than happy to get rid of you. The politics in Australia was fascinating in the late 60s, early 70s. We'd lived through 23 years of Liberal government before there was a change in party and we moved to the Labor Party under Gough Whitlam. It was an extraordinary moment for those of us who were only about 23 years old. For many of us could not remember any time, a large section of the community could not remember any time when anybody but the Liberals ruled. And when the Labor government came in under Gough Whitlam, it was with tremendous popularity, overwhelming popularity. It was a huge landslide. And that was that without Mr. McKerris telling us it was. But then 3 years later, Mr. Whitlam was kicked out of power with just as much a landslide going in the other direction, as the country was thoroughly and utterly sick of him for various reasons. Come back to Mr. Whitlam in a few moments' time as you'll see why. You see, who are the successors? Menzies, that period of time that people lived in and the elderly people in our community think now is a golden age, was followed by Gough, who those people can't stand, and another group of people think was the greatest man who ever worked. He's got a book here called A Certain Grandeur. There's a Labor viewpoint of Mr. Whitlam. In fact, I'm surprised he didn't write it himself. I don't think it is anyway. And of course you're followed by Malcolm and Fraser, and of course people, and then you're followed by Bob Hawke, and of course no one likes him now, and then you're followed by Paul, and who likes him, especially when he's overseas, and then who comes next, and do you think it's going to make any difference? You need to have to live long enough to see that they come, they go, they make no difference. You think the next one's going to make a change that will improve anything? Do you think John Howard's actually going to change things for the better? Within a year or two they'd get sick of him, just like they're sick of Paul Keating. You think one after John Howard, or within a year or two, they get sick of him too? Who's the successor? And all the time, the poor are oppressed. All the changes of the government, the poor still pay the taxes. All the time, the politicians and the civil servants are growing wealthier with their pensions and their cars and their drivers down at their swimming pool and their squash courts. Parliament House is a magnificent place to visit in Macquarie Street, let alone down in Canberra. The bar that they've got available to them day and night, it's a wonderful place to be. The first class air travel that they can have for the rest of their lives if they've stayed long enough in Parliament is a wonderful work and perk to be on. The kind of business directorships that they get out of a few, you want to get ahead, go to Parliament. You've got to put up with a lot of nonsense for several years, but afterwards you live. But what of my wealth? Maybe it's not political power. What of my wealth? Here is the real value. Here's the fruit of my labour. Whoever has the most money when he dies wins, after all. Here is the value of everything, isn't it? It's not idealistic, but it's real. It's tangible. It's value with a number. But of course, it's totally unsatisfying. Chapter 5, verse 10. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with the income. This too is meaningless. And so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner, except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of the labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich man permits him no sleep. Or chapter 6, verses 7 and 9, chapter 6, all man's efforts are for his mouth, and yet his appetite is never satisfied, as we read a few moments ago. You see, wealth is fundamentally unsatisfying. You never have enough. Which part of society is satisfied? Is it the wealthy? No, it's not. They earn a lot and they're hungry for more. But our storybooks, the morality tales of our newspapers, our magazines, you know, the Who, the Women's Day, the Women's Weekly, whatever it is, the Poll, the Picks, that the Time magazine, the Business Weekly Review, whatever one you want to go, the stories of the people are stories of rich people who are dissatisfied and discontent and greedy for yet more. The 1980s was the great period of greed. And now names like Bond and Skase are household names. They are words that have almost entered into the vocabulary. You've done a Skase. I mean, the wealth, did it satisfy? It is endless as you watch Mr. Murdoch and you watch Mr. Packer and you watch these people who have got more money than they possibly conceivably could know what to do with it, desperately seeking to make yet more money and yet more money and yet more money, and oppressing little people all the time in the process as they buy and sell other people's lives and businesses for the sake of growing in yet more and more of nothing. It's all meaningless. Furthermore, wealth is so transient, he says in chapter 5, verse 13, following. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs, and what does he gain since he toils for the wind? All his days he eats in darkness and great frustration, affliction and anger. At the end of the day, what do you got? It's an old saying I was taught as a child, which is almost lost today because people don't know what it means. There's no pockets in shrouds. But as most people don't know what a shroud is, that doesn't help them very much, does it? Just in case you are not in the arts faculty and therefore have a limited vocabulary, a shroud is the mantle that you wrap up the corpse in as you bury it. There are no pockets in shrouds. You can't take it with you. If you can't take it with you, what's the point of earning it? If, you know, the whole schema is whoever has the most money when he dies wins, what does he win? What is it that he has gained? It's also transient. Who can be sure of wealth even in this lifetime, though? For you can lose it all on a risk, can't you? You can lose it in a bank that goes out or in a property trust that fails. You can lose it on the market. Have you heard of a man called Leeson recently? You can lose it anywhere. And you mustn't think that there is a safe place in which it can be put, because there isn't. You can't put it under your bed and keep it, because inflation will eat it away. You can't invest it in securities, because securities are fundamentally insecure. There is no place where you can have it and keep it and be assured of its future. But not only is it transient, we are transient, chapter 6, verse 1. I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions, and honour so that he lacks nothing in his heart's desire, but God doesn't enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them. And this is meaningless and a grievous evil. You make your money, and you die, and others get it. The quarrels, the squabbles over wills that have taken place in our society, the people who have gone to court challenging other people about who should have whose money. If you want to divide a family, have lots of money and leave an uncertain will. So what value is their wealth without enjoyment? What value is their wealth if you're too sick to enjoy it, or too dead to know that you've got it, or too worried to actually participate in it? Chapter 6, verse 3, a man may have 100 children and may live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning, it departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but fails to enjoy his prosperity. Do not all go to the same place. Well, you're getting used to the idea that Ecclesiastes is relatively pessimistic, aren't you? It does raise a big problem, though, because you know something about people who are philosophical materialists? The only lifestyle they've got is materialism. Why is our society fundamentally economically driven, materialistically driven? Because our society has chosen a philosophy called materialism. A philosophy which says there is no God, there are no spiritual realities, there are no values, there is just the universe. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. And if that is the case, all I can try and do is acquire as much here as I can while I'm here. And it doesn't make sense. So if the upward mobility is a trap, what about the downward mobility? I mean, there's a choice, isn't there? You could choose to opt out. You could choose to reject the material worldview, growth and progress, power, status, significance, competition, anxiety. You can opt for the simple lifestyle of dropping out. You can have the brown rice, the raw sugar, the insecticide fruit, the biodynamic kind of food, the mysticism, the communalism, the naturalism, that kind of option that is available to you. Jim Cairns was one of the intellectual leaders of the government of Gough Whitlam. Dr. Jim Cairns, as he was always, an economics man, very left-wing on the Labour Party. Some, of course, who were on the right wing said that he wasn't on the left wing of the Labour Party, he was a communist. But he would say he was just the left wing of the Labour Party. He was very prominent, was Jim Cairns, until he was sacked. By the end of 1974, Cairns was passing through a time of deep personal change, a period of self-doubt and self-questioning. He found himself caught up in a massive self-contradiction. He was going through a phase of profound personal indecision, yet sought responsibilities which called for almost daily for important decisions. He had reached the peaks of power as deputy leader of the Labour Party, deputy prime minister and treasurer, at the very time in which he'd become deeply disillusioned with the exercise of executive power. By seeking and accepting these great offices, he committed himself to responsibility for the system at the same time as when he had never been so alienated from the system. He claimed a dominant role in solving the immediate concrete problems of inflation and unemployment at the very time he was coming to believe in the impossibility of any solution. He found himself as the head of the Treasury, the most cynical, arrogant, hard-nosed department at a time when he was developing a theory of economics based unashamedly on the language of love. On the 3rd of September 1974, within weeks of becoming the Treasurer, he stated in his Chifley Memorial Lecture at Melbourne University, quote, "I have come to a position in life in which I value most, as a source or as a confirmation, the words of men who are simple and real. I have come to a rejection, even a fear of men who make basic philosophy complex and intellectual, or who base it upon an untested or abstract assumption. We have learnt little from the halls of fame or from intellectual towers or even from the campuses that help us to understand how to live or how to love." Cairns dropped out of public life and got himself involved in... Quote, "I have come to a position in life in which I value most as a source of, or as a confirmation, the words of men who are simple and real. I have come to a rejection, even a fear of men who make basic philosophy complex and intellectual, or who base it upon an untested or abstract assumption. We have learnt little from the halls of fame, or from intellectual towers, or even from the campuses that help us to understand how to live or how to love." Cairns dropped out of public life and got himself involved in the Green Movement, producing books like this one, on the growth to freedom. He saw the whole materialism was a complete loss, complete waste of time. Economics, PhD, treasurer of our country. He just dropped the bundle completely and said, the whole industrial Western civilization, materialistic, it's nonsense. We've got to just go back into the simple. And so here he has the alternative to drop out. And he writes things like, now, the core of the alternative is that under natural conditions, the vital energies of the human person regulate themselves spontaneously into a life that can be free, self-fulfilling, at the same time, as a result, socially cooperative and affectional. Free and natural action of vital personal energies create a good self-feeling, self-love, the very thought that many people can't tolerate, and this results in an equally good feeling in others. I know it can happen because I've seen it happen over and over again. Psychic health depends on the flow or exercise of the natural capacity for self-fulfillment. Antisocial behaviour springs from secondary drives, not principal needs, which owe their existence to unnatural suppression and repression of natural needs, especially sexuality. Neuroses in all its degrees is a disturbance of the nature. And so it goes on, and there are lovely pictures of him at a gathering here with hundreds of other people standing naked in a river at the water celebration in the 1976 Down to Earth Confest held at the Cotter River in ACT. And little quotes, "The unity that binds us all together, that makes this earth a family and all men brothers, and so the sons of God, is love." And he just dropped out. Intellectually, philosophically, and in fact, he just dropped out. Now, our author's not a sentimentalist like Jim Cairns. He's a realist. Chapter 4, verse 5. "The fool folds his hands and ruins himself." It's hardly a sentimental view of dropping out. Because dropping out is the paradise of the wealthy. People live and eat and sleep and die in the streets of Calcutta. They don't drop out into Nimbin to have a countercultural experience in the Nud down at the Cotter River. You have to be very middle class, bored and a trendy, and very wealthy to be able to afford hippiedom. And you'll notice that in the hippiedoms of Nimbin and the rest, it's all written up on personal computers, it's all recorded on video, and it's all played to acoustic guitars. You have to be very wealthy to drop out, and a little stupid. But in so dismissing anti-materialism, he makes one of the first of his comparisons. The logic of it he gives in chapter 2, verse 13, but here it is again now. Verse 5, it's not only the fool, verse 6, but also the workaholic has got to know his limit. "The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind." It's comparison as a method of argument. It's not saying this is right and that is wrong. It's just saying this is better than that. I don't know what is right. And so there's a series of these comparisons that we get. Chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. The first one is the moderation. To drop out is foolish. To be a workaholic is hopeless. And therefore, it's better to have a moderation, to have a balance between work and rest. The pursuit of mediocrity is what he's on, not the pursuit of excellence. That's a biblical view. It's a pagan view that you pursue excellence. It's difficult, of course, if you're a university person, a person going into professional life, because university actually doesn't train us so much with information as it trains us to become workaholics. It trains us to expectations, competitiveness, to rise up, whereas the Bible says what we need to be trained in is keeping a balance between work and rest. 6 days you labour and 1 day you rest. He's saying, better to have a little bit with rest than everything with no rest. Or the second comparison is in verses 9 to 12. It's society. Society is better than solitude. Two is better than one, verses 9 to 12. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. And if two lie together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. You see, there's advantage in being in company, in society. And yet our society, of course, is increasingly living alone. The third comparison I pick up is in chapter 4, verse 13. Better the poor and wise young man who's teachable than the old and powerful king who's unteachable. And there's a fourth one, though, which is really the big leap forward. In chapter 5, verses 1 to 7, better to listen to God than to talk. Guard your steps when you go, chapter 5, verse 1. Go to your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know what they are, that they do wrong. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven. You are on earth. So let your words be few. As a dream comes when there are many cares, so the speech of a fool when there are many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay in fulfilling it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It's better not to vow than to make a vow and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin, and do not protest to the temple messenger, "Oh, my vow was a mistake." Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the work of your hands? Much dreaming, many words, meaningless. Therefore, stand in awe of God. See, it's better to listen. This is not just under the sun. This is in the temple. This is in the presence of God. It's better to listen to God than to babble on like a fool. For the sacrifice of the fools is much talking. And remember who you're talking to. Remember who you're talking about. It's to God. He's in heaven, you're on earth. He knows what it's about, you don't. Instead of listening, our fools are always talking. You get it in that language. You'll hear it in the conversations around about you. If you just talk about God, you'll find somebody next to no time will say a sentence like, I like to think of God as. That is one of the most stupid introductions to a sentence. That is the most stupid idea that has ever... Because what it's saying is, I make God. The very nature of God is that he made me. For me to be saying, this is what I want God to be, this is how God should be, I only will accept God if he comes in these terms, says, I am God. But yet, people do it. They babble on. They think their ideas about God are more important than God's ideas about them. And so we want to sit in judgment on God, who is our judge. When you get into the court, pay careful attention as to whether you're in the dock or on the bench. And if you're in the dock, can I encourage you, don't judge. Only if you're on the bench should you be judging. But we come into the very presence of God and then we tell him what he should be doing. Doesn't know his business. Obviously got it wrong, hasn't he? Made me. So let's pull together what's here in this little passage. How far have we got? What are the answers? Life's a misery. Work, wealth, power, status. It's all deceit, really. It looks like answers, but it's meaningless. It keeps us busy, but it's meaningless. We think it's important that a person is a judge and a dentist, and we think it's unimportant that a person is a street sweeper or a sewer worker. But what's the difference? Why do we have one group up on the pedestal and the other group down? We think it's important to live in St. Ives or Vaucluse, and we think it's unimportant to live in Auburn. But why do we prefer one to another? We have these pecking orders of society and these status symbols that are so important to us. And the author says it's all trivia, really. And we've just got to learn to enjoy trivia. Verse 18 of chapter 5. And I realise that it's good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find his satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given him. For this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, well, that's a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. The only way to enjoy life, just get so busy that you don't think about it. That's the way to enjoy life, which of course is stupidity. And so you have an unenjoyable trivia, verse 12 of chapter 6, verse 10 to 12. Whatever exists is already named. What a man has been known, no man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more words, the less meaning. How does the profit anyone? For who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? Given that everything is transient, given that things and self and life itself is of no real value and it all just comes and goes, then more words are actually more meaninglessness and more futility. We live it out with no profit. If you had all the days of this universe, you couldn't read the books that are in that library that are just up the hill there from us. And do they in the end tell us anything more than we need to know that life is about playing tennis and then playing croquet and then playing push up the daisies? However, we've started to see that there are values in the comparisons, that there are some things it's better this than that. It's better to have some work and rest rather than all work or all rest. It's better to live in society than to live alone. It's better to be poor and wise than to be rich and foolish. There are some ways that are better than other ways. But the real better is to listen to God. For the fool's words are the endless words that give no wisdom. Telling God what should be, making up what should and shouldn't be, what must and mustn't be. The unteachable spirit that sits in the situation of ignorance where no wisdom is to be found other than meaningless and still gives out advice. A recent newspaper article I read, this man argued in the paper that the Judeo-Christian view of the world was completely wrong, but we should follow its ethics because we've got nothing else to go by. Why not come to the reality that meaninglessness means I've got nothing to say instead of writing books on meaninglessness? It's like the deconstructionists who want to tell us that the author has no meaning. The only person who has meaning is the reader. But they write books themselves as authors to persuade us to that viewpoint. Have you ever contemplated the contradiction that is involved in that? Every time I meet up with a deconstructionist, I assure him that I understand exactly what he means. That he means that every author has great meaning in what he writes. And they say, no, that's not what I mean. And I say, yes, I know, I just heard you. Every author has meaning in what he writes. You always got to take the author's meaning, because that's the only meaning that is there. And they say, no, no, you haven't understood me, Philip. I'm saying the exact reverse. The author's meaning is irrelevant. It's only the listener's meaning that takes any sense. And I say, yes, I'm the listener, and I know that what you're saying is that every author only has meaning. Why will they not face the meaninglessness that they believe in and shut up? Because more talk is just more meaninglessness. And if we shut up, we might start listening to God. For we should stand in awe of God. For my friends, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And when we listen, we will come to meet Christ, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Let's pray. We thank and praise you, Heavenly Father, that you have spoken, and we pray that you would give to us that wisdom that comes from fear of you. And we pray it in Jesus' name.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.